talking all things wound care. This is The Pressure Effect, brought to you by Smith & Nephew.
Welcome to The Pressure Effect from Smith & Nephew. I'm your host, Dr. Lee Rutze. In this episode, we'll be diving into a key area that impacts countless patients dealing with pressure injuries, and that is infection. Pressure injuries can be complex to manage, especially when infection is involved. And understanding the nuances of assessment, treatment, and prevention of infection is vital. Joining us to discuss this subject is my colleague at the Saratoga Hospital Center for Wound Healing and Hyperbaric Medicine, Dot Weir, RN, CWO, and CWS. This is also probably a good time to disclose that not only is Dot my colleague at the wound center, she's also my wife. She and I have had these conversations a few times. Dot has spent over 4 decades practicing wound care, and I can tell you that I have probably learned more wound care from Dot than I have from any other single source. Dot is here now to share insights on detecting biofilms, managing microbial resistance, and the best practices for both local and systemic care. So let's get started. Dot, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your background, your nursing background. How did you get to the point that you're at today in your practice, your knowledge, and your skills? And secondarily, what got you interested in wound care in the first place?
Well, my journey has been a wonderful one. I became a nurse in 1976, but as early as 1980, I was in the right place, right time, and I was given the opportunity to go to intrastomal therapy school at that time. So this is 1980. We were called ET nurses, and it was mostly, the role was mostly ostomy, but a little smattering of wound care. And at the time, during 1979, 1980-ish, this is when we were just starting to have products and to start focusing on a moist environment in the wound bed, getting rid of a lot of wet to dries and some of the old things that were, you know, just what were how we'd always done it. And so as ET nurses, which were later called WOC, or wound ostomy incontinence nurses, the same companies that made ostomy supplies were the first ones to bring out wound care supplies. So we were the target or the first call for them. And it was fabulous because we were on the front lines of learning how to use these things and how to interpret the differences that we were seeing with moist wound healing versus letting things dry out, educating our colleagues, educating physicians, because it was all new back then. So that started me off. And then I worked for 8 years in home care after about 4 years in acute care. Then I went into industry for 7 years. And in 2001, went back out into 100% wound care and a little bit of ostomy by joining an outpatient wound care center. So since 2001, that's all I've done is outpatient wound care. And mostly practiced in Florida and moved up for obvious reasons in 2017 to New York. And then you and I moved over to start our new clinic in Saratoga Springs in 2019. So that's my journey. And I've been blessed with a lot of opportunities with the Symposium in Advanced Wound Care. I'm on the International Wound Infection Institute, which is why I have such a keen interest in this topic. And so, yeah, so it's just been a very nice evolution for me, continuously learning all the way as we all need to continue to learn all the way.
When you're in clinic, how would you describe your day-to-day clinical role?
Well, I work part-time. When we started the clinic that we're in now, I was the only one with one other nurse. And I was not only a clinic nurse, but I was also sort of the trainer. And now there's a full staff there. I backed out to part-time because of a lot of other extracurricular things that I do. So I'm really more in the role, a little bit of a leader trainer. And it's been a great journey because these nurses that we have now that we work with are just hungry for knowledge and have really embraced wound management. Of course, you're the leader there, so that helps a lot, you and Haley. But that's really my role, is really one more of a sort of an educator.
That's been so important that Dot had the opportunity to educate all of the nurses that we have. And we say tongue in cheek to each other, we're happy we got them from scratch because we got to train them the right way.
Absolutely.
All right. So Dot, now that the audience knows you a little bit better, let's get down to talking about infection management. So, what are the earliest signs clinicians should look for when assessing a pressure injury for potential infection? And before you answer, for the group, you already alluded to this, but I think your background and your experience with the IWII, the International Wound Infection Institute, has been a really important and enjoyable journey for you as well. So I'm sure you're going to include that in some of our conversation today.
So, I mean, when you're looking, you know, the pressure injuries are so complex. It depends on where you encounter them in terms of the evolution. You know, if it's still intact skin, whether it's a stage one that was previously blanching and now it's not, versus, say, something that's a deep tissue pressure injury or something that's unstageable or something that's able to be staged as, say, a 3 or a 4. Those are so varied in terms of what you would look for in terms of infection. But let's start with a wound that's necrotic, because that necrotic tissue is just a breeding ground for bacteria. So there may be an odor associated with it. And it's sometimes a little difficult to discern if it's bacterial odor or if it's just the odor associated with necrotic tissue, lending itself to the recommendation that as long as it's appropriate for the patient, that we get that necrotic tissue debrided out as quickly as possible. But when you're assessing a wound, let's say that is free of necrotic tissue, that takes on a whole different look. If you're taking care of a patient, and I have found that pressure injuries don't always have the first reaction of erythema around the edge. They certainly can. But I think the thing that we start noticing first is a change in the color and the character of the, let's take a clean wound of the granulation tissue. Maybe it's more friable. Maybe it bleeds a little more easily. If the person has sensation, they may have more pain associated with it. And it's definitely a change in the character of the exudate as well as the odor that might be coming from exudate but previously was, say, no odor or, you know, clear. Maybe it takes on a purulent appearance to it or the cloudy appearance to it. So there's a lot of subtleties in pressure injury assessment for infection that I think are different from different from assessing, say, diabetic foot ulcer or a leg ulcer for an infection. So we have to be cued into very subtle changes so that we can recognize early that there is something going awry. But I would say if I had to pick one or two things, it would be a change in the odor of the drainage and the character of the drainage. Or it could just be that the wound was moving along and healing nicely and suddenly stops. So the International Wound Infection Institute has a very nice wound care continuum that sort of breaks it down from, you know, contamination, which we know all wounds are contaminated, to colonization, the replication of bacteria. And then moving on to seeing subtle signs, which could be as subtle as it's not healing like it was before, pocketing or a change in the granulation to more overt signs. And that would be more purulence and changes with the patients, maybe now seeing some erythema around the edge. But again, I don't think we see the same dramatic signs in pressure injuries, unfortunately, because that could help a lot that we see in some other types of wounds.
This is something that you and I have spent some time talking about over the years. How can we differentiate between a normal inflammatory response and signs of infection in a pressure injury or any other wound for that matter?
Well, I have a picture that I use frequently when I'm teaching the wound healing process. And it's a picture of a cell phone with a scrape on it and some erythema around it. You know, if you do wound care, you always get pictures from your family saying, is this infected? And so, I mean, let's take it out of the pressure injury right now. If it's a venous leg ulcer or some sort of trauma, in those first 3 to 5 days, erythema in the area is normal inflammation. That's normal signs of inflammation. The vessels are dilating to be able to, you know, send in the right side of cells at the right time. But in a pressure injury, I haven't ever thought about this really, but I don't believe that we really see signs of inflammation. So let's start with a stage one. If we're a reddened area, if it's reddened and it blanches, then that's just normal reactive hyperemia and it should resolve. If it's reddened and it doesn't blanch, then we call that a stage one. And that is probably the closest that we're going to see to an inflammatory response. because now the vessels are dilated, the body is responding to the injury or the pressure. Once it's a stage two, which is not really a deeper tissue injury, often caused more by friction and shearing on the surface versus shearing down deep in the tissues, again, we may see a normal inflammatory response. But once a wound has been full thickness, maybe it's been debrided, certainly you could create a new inflammatory response by a surgical debridement, but I don't believe we're not going to see the classic signs of inflammation that we see in an acute wound. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes perfect sense. So next comes the million-dollar question. Can you explain the role of biofilm in the development and persistence of infection? Again, not only in pressure injuries, but in other injuries. And I feel at this time like I just want to give a quick shout out to a dear friend of Dots and mine, Dr. Gregory Schultz, who sadly passed away unexpectedly over the last year. But Dr. Schultz has really developed and provided us with much of the information that we have in this day and age regarding biofilm. So again, Dot, to repeat the question, explain the role of biofilm in the development and persistence of infection in pressure injuries and other wounds.
Well, I think we have to separate out biofilm from infection. If you're not familiar with biofilm, to try and give a quick visual, bacteria that are sitting on the surface of the wound that we can wash away, that we culture if we use just a regular swab culture, those are called planktonic. They're free-floating, they're low-hanging fruit, they're easy to target. They're going to be susceptible to any kind of antimicrobials that we might use, would be more susceptible to antibiotics, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But they're easy to kill. Once they have been in the wound for a while, they become sessile or attached, and they begin to replicate, and they begin to organize, and they have their own special way of communication called quorum sensing. But they exude this exopolymeric substance, just sort of this polysaccharide slime that now covers them and protects them from the patient's own immune system, from our topical antimicrobials, from our antibiotics. There are a couple of antimicrobials that will penetrate, but for the most part, they're self-protective. And so we do call it biofilm infections, but it's not always a true infection, but it is something that is a foreign body sitting on the surface of the wound that's going to interfere with wound healing. The bacteria are ensconced in this exopolymer substance. They go into hibernation, so they slow their metabolism down. So their needs for oxygen are lessened. Their needs for they don't respond to antibiotics as readily because they don't uptake the antibiotic into the cell of the bacteria. So it's been estimated that I think the number now is like 60-70% of chronic wounds have some level of biofilm. But I personally, and I'm not 100% expert on this, that's for sure, but I personally think that there are different ways that people, that different wounds that respond differently to having the presence of biofilm. The conventional way to get rid of them is a good debridement. You excise them off the surface, you can disrupt the film that's protecting them, and that exposes the bacteria to whatever antimicrobial that you might put on. And so that makes it easier to treat. But then we have wounds that have been around, you know, that are being taken care of at home, that haven't had any kind of debridement yet. They go on to heal. So I think there's still a lot to be learned about the phenotype of bacteria that we call biofilm, but it's definitely there and it's definitely well researched. I 100% believe that biofilm is an issue. And so it all revolves around good wound care, good debridement, good wound cleansing, and aggressive wound cleansing to the extent that you can in order to keep that bioburden at a reasonable level. And then if you do suspect a biofilm presence and you do a debridement using an antimicrobial approach topically, not systemically, but topically to help reduce the bacterial growth, so hopefully reducing the reformation of the biofilm.
Well, the logical continuation of that question then is, what methods are most effective for detecting biofilms in pressure injuries? And roughly speaking, how accurate are those various approaches?
Well, that's our challenge. We don't have a good diagnostic available at this point in time. So in our clinic and in many clinics, we have a fluorescence imaging device. It doesn't detect biofilm at all. It just detects the presence of bacteria alive and dead. So it can help to guide our cleansing, help to guide our debridements, but It doesn't diagnose anything. The closest that I know of is a test that's out of Japan. And in fact, Greg Schultz, and I know Jeff Niesgoda and some others in the US were testing it. And it's a fabric that you lay on top of the wound. Now you have to map it out. And when you take the fabric away, the exopolymeric substance where it has come in contact with that fabric actually colorizes or changes the color of the fabric. So it's a little unwieldy from people I've talked to that have tried it. But, you know, that's what everybody's working on. Can we identify where it is? Because it's not necessarily diffuse across the whole wound bed. And so if we could identify where it is, we could target our debridement and could target our cleansing. So at this point in time, nobody has that because it's not available. I don't think it's FDA approved in the US yet. But, you know, a lot of us do use the fluorescence imaging. There's a couple of different devices out that will at least identify where it is so we can target our cleansing and target our debridement that way.
So thinking about the diagnostic tests that are currently recommended and available for identifying infections and pressure injuries, how reliable are they and what are some of the new technologies or suggested testing methods that are emerging that might help us be more effective in diagnosing infections? And I know you just described the sheet that is not yet available in the US, but what other things can you think of? What other methods are out there?
Well, culturing is one way, but culturing is not going to tell you what's inside of a biofilm. So if we're going to do a culture, we would want to disrupt the biofilm in order to try to get to planktonic bacteria. Greg Schultz was always a big believer of sending DNA samples off. You know, they're just swab samples, but you can send it off for DNA testing that looks to find the DNA of the bacteria that were there and sort of and try to help guide treatment that way. But at this point in time, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of things in the works, but from our day-to-day clinical, it's all assessment. And the problem with biofilm is that you can't see it. And I'll read charts and it says, oh, I used a curette to remove the biofilm. Well, biofilm is microscopic. What people see is a sort of a yellowish sheen, sometimes a gelatinous coating that may be present because of the presence of the biofilm, but the actual biofilm itself is microscopic, attaches to the surface, it embeds about a few microns down into the wound bed. So there's nothing visual that we can see. It's a presumptive assessment, a presumptive diagnosis, simply based on the fact that maybe the wound's not epithelializing or maybe the granulation stops, some of the things that we've already talked about. So we're at a point now, I mean, there are some antimicrobial dressings that are available. You know, one is Codexmer iodine, for example, reportedly will remove a biofilm. Some of the good wound cleansers that have a high therapeutic index will be effective in the long run against biofilms, such as hypochlorous acid, PHMB, gelling fiber dressing that has EDTA is reported to be effective against biofilm. So the world is working. The manufacturers are working on this. So they can't make a lot of claims about it, but their early research does show that many of them are effective for breaking the biofilm polymer, not so much as getting to the bacteria, but first you got to get rid of the coating that's protecting them. But I still think that cold hard steel is really the best way to disrupt the surface of the biofilm and then appropriately applied antimicrobial dressings hopefully can reduce the bioburden so the biofilm ceases to continue to replicate.
You know, and Dot mentioned the fluorescence imaging instrument. Another thing that helps us do, it helps us guide our debridement so that as we are using that cold hard steel to debride the surface of a wound, we have a little bit more accurate information about whether we're actually getting rid of bacteria in the process. So what do you think about how healthcare providers should approach infection control in order to mitigate microbial resistance in pressure injuries?
Good wound care. It all starts with good wound care. And I'm a big zealot about wound cleansing because one of the other things that the IWII is working on, and if you're not familiar with the International Wound Infection Institute, you can Google it, but we have an infection continuum that we published in 2022, and it will be published again in 2026. It has a nice continuum for wound management, biofilm-based wound care. But, you know, we have to go back to the basics of what we know about wound care, good debridement, but good wound cleansing. As a nurse, and I so love our clinic because they've all embraced the whole concept of wound cleansing. One of the things that we know is that there's a tremendous amount of bacteria that is in the peri-wound area. And so the wound cleansing document that's going to come out next year from the IWII has actually defined the peri-wound, the skin immediately adjacent. We've even defined toe flossing, for goodness sakes, so that, you know, because all the bacteria is hiding in all these places. And so it's remarkable when you fluoresce a wound in the peri-wound skin to see how much bacteria is actually on the skin. So the recommendation for wound cleansing is that we cleanse the wound, certainly, but then we also cleanse the peri-wound 10 to 20 centimeters out. Do good leg hygiene if somebody is wearing a compression wrap and has had a dressing on for 7 solid days. So again, starting with the good basics of wound debridement, wound cleansing can go a long way towards preventing biofilm formation. Once we, and having a trial, and the recommendation is a 2-week trial to use an antimicrobial, we want to practice antimicrobial stewardship just like we practice antibiotic stewardship, because the concern certainly is about resistance, but also Greg used to talk a lot about the tolerance. There's some tolerance that bacteria can develop, not necessarily being totally resistant to it, but they learn to coexist with some of these antimicrobials that we put on. And so the recommendation is to use something for 2, maybe 3 weeks, and then switch to something else so that we reduce the potential for that tolerance. But again, not, you know, culturing is a way to confirm an infection. You know, our infections are diagnosed by our clinical signs and symptoms and all the classic things that we all learned in our basic training: erythema, warmth, induration, pain, odor. You know, all those things are still what we're going to look for in an infection. And then if we are clinically diagnosing an infection, then we do a culture, and we do a good culture. You clean the wound, you debride the wound, you make sure you stop the bleeding, and then you do, if you're going to do a swab, if you're not familiar with the Levine technique, since I can't demonstrate it here, look it up. It's a method for obtaining an ideal swab culture, which has about a 70 to 80% correlation if done correctly. So all we can do is that, because most people do not do tissue biopsy cultures. Now they do them in surgery, and there are a few areas where, especially if they're a surgeon, but mostly many cultures are done by nurses, and they're not necessarily advanced practice that can take tissue out of somebody. So doing a good culture and then following that culture with treatment, this falls into your realm, with the antibiotic that you may choose because of the color of the drainage, the odor, what maybe the patient has had an infection with before. And then one other thing I would add is always to be suspicious of the patient who may not have the most ideal immune system, who may be immunosuppressed for any reason, someone with diabetes, for example. We may want a little bit lower bar for culturing because they may not exhibit the typical signs and symptoms of infection.
Tell us next a little bit about the choice of dressings or topical treatments and how those choices impact the outcomes of infection management.
Well, we have a variety of different antimicrobials available to us. I think everyone has silver, and I know our materials management folks would like us to have just one. You know, why do you need more than one kind of silver? Well, you're not only choosing an antimicrobial, but you're also choosing exudate management. And so if you have a wound that's relatively dry, but you feel like you need antimicrobial, then you might use a silver gel. If you have a drain that's draining a lot, then you're not going to use a gel. You may use a hydrofiber or a gelling fiber or a calcium alginate that has silver in it. And then there are dressings with pH and B, cadexin or iodine. There's copper dressings out. I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but there's pigmented foams and with crystal violet, Jensen violet, and methylene blue. So I think having a lot of options to not only be able to switch out our antimicrobial, but also to change in relationship to the amount of exudate that we're needing to manage to, creates the opportunity to try to get that all under control. But again, if you don't need the antimicrobial, then switch to something that's, if you're using a silver alginate, switch to an alginate that's not, doesn't have an antimicrobial in it, so that we practice good antimicrobial stewardship.
two or three questions that are in my mind, but I think the one that sort of sums it up is this. What considerations do you think clinicians should use and weigh when they're deciding between local or topical and systemic treatments for infection prevention or treatment in pressure injuries?
Systemic treatment should be reserved for something that is truly infected. That's where a well-done culture, if clinical signs and symptoms of infection are present, that's when we do it. Now, and we've all had wounds that have fooled us. You know, you just keep plugging along. They don't have true classic signs and symptoms of infection, then they go on antibiotics and they get better. So sometimes that's a default. But the choice should always be driven by our clinical assessment, supported by the culture to confirm that what we're treating them with empirically is the right one. Or if, you know, if the patient's had problems or history with resistant organisms, then probably a culture-driven choice might be the better answer for them. And that's where our infectious disease colleagues are so critically important to help guide us when we're dealing with resistant organisms. That's certainly not my area of expertise, but we know they're there. You know, if you just look at a lot of pressure injuries in the sacrum and the ischial tuberosities and the neighborhood that they're in, is not good. And so the potential for contamination is there. And then, you know, repeated growth of different microorganisms certainly could breed some resistance there. But again, we start with the best wound care, treat when we need to treat, but hopefully be able to treat topically as much as possible.
And finally, then, what are some of the proactive steps that you can think of that healthcare teams can take to reduce the risk of infection in patients with pressure injuries?
100% good education on the part of the patient, starting with good nutrition. You know, optimizing the host is obviously always going to be what we want to do. Good nutrition, pressure redistribution, the adequate control of exudate and management of the wound surface. But you know, just educate, managing incontinence if that's an issue for the patient. There's so many factors that come into play with pressure injuries. Now, I've been focusing on the pressure injuries of the trunk. Obviously, they can have, you know, heel ulcers, for example. But those type of wounds are probably some of the more risky, I would think, now that I say that out loud, because they are on the lower extremity. Many times the perfusion is not ideal. They're down by the floor. So their environment's not always great either. So, but regardless of where it is, the wound is located, optimizing the host and doing, you know, the best possible wound care, educating, having, you know, good support for the family, getting them right, the dressings that they need through their insurance, if that's available. And then, you know, we don't tend to use some of the more advanced products. We certainly with trunk pressure injuries, I think if there's any size or depth to them, then negative pressure wound therapy is definitely a way that you can manage that exudate. It helps to disrupt the surface if you're using the foam contact dressing. So, you know, that's an ideal way to manage exudate and help to reduce the bacterial load. And then on the lower extremity and on the feet, if they become recalcitrant, then that might be where someone might use a cellular tissue-based products because they have those that also have antimicrobials in them. So there's a lot of possibilities. It's just, I think, every single time doing a good assessment, finding out where the patient is, making sure our measurements are moving in the right direction, and just being very tuned in to the potential for infection so that we key in on it and do something about it as earlier rather than later.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this goes back to some of the fundamentals of wound care, that we want our wounds to have a moist environment. We want them to be at body temperature, and we want them to be protected from potentially infectious sources in the outside environment. So that just about wraps up our conversation for today, Dot. Any final thoughts that you'd like to share on anything that we've discussed today, or if there's something that I have neglected to ask you?
I feel like we covered it pretty well. I think that my strongest, the thing that I find myself really rallying behind and speaking on a lot is just the good wound bed preparation. my saying is clean it like you mean it. We've got to keep these wounds clean. We got to do good wound hygiene. Another paper that I was involved with that, again, I think brought to the forefront the importance of good wound cleansing. And then the IWII wound cleansing document will be out in February. So there's a lot of chatter about it, and there's good data behind that chatter. So we just stay tuned. I think we're going to continue to learn. I think the industry is going to continue to potentially give us products and things that we can, you know, continue to fight this fight so that we, you know, pressure injuries being the problem, but the infection and the bacteria being the contributing factor to the non-healing.
Well, I think that was a really good and thorough coverage of this topic. And Dot, thanks again for taking the time to join us. And I say with a smile on my face, I look forward to seeing you soon.
Me too. Thank you.
Well, that wraps up today's conversation on infections and pressure injuries. I hope you found our deep dive into assessment, biofilm detection, and treatment options as valuable as I did. A big thank you to Dot for sharing her expertise and shedding light on ways that we can improve patient outcomes through proactive infection management. Remember, pressure injuries don't have to result in infection when we're equipped with the right knowledge and tools. And to all of you, thank you for listening to The Pressure Effect. Be sure to like and subscribe to our show and join us next time as we continue exploring the many facets of pressure injury prevention and patient care. I'm Dr. Lee Rutze, signing off for now, and until we speak again, stay committed to making a difference in patient outcomes. This has been The Pressure Effect, brought to you by Smith & Nephew.